I think we've talked in the past about how history isn't the judge or the indicator that it used to be, that so many conventions and rules have been broken in the last decade or so that whether you're a stock picker or a political prognosticator, there's not necessarily too much point in looking at history as a guide to the future.
That was Daniel Wagner, and on this episode of the All Things Risk podcast, we look at the big picture in 2018 and 2019. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is my show. If you're new to our show, this is where we tackle risk and uncertainty from a range of perspectives with a couple of objectives. One is to help us all embrace these things, and two is to help us understand the biggest risks and uncertainties of our times so that we can do something about them. And I'm going to keep this intro short and simple. This episode is a look back at some of 2018's big picture risks in geopolitics, technology, society, and the economy, how these things played out, and a look ahead at what to watch in these areas in 2019. My guest is none other than Daniel Wagner, who I've had on the show now 6 or 7 times. And we did this episode in the same format last year, and it was fun and interesting, and I thought we could do it again. If you're new to Daniel and you don't know who he is an expert on country risk. He owns and is the CEO of his firm, Country Risk Solutions. He's also a prolific author and commentator. And because we did the same thing last year, I thought it would be useful to review how Daniel's thoughts and forecasts for 2018 played out. And we get into all of that. We talk about the USA and China, Saudi Arabia, cybersecurity, technological change. And we also discuss a few things to be positive about. We even touch on sex robots, in addition to looking ahead at other things to watch in 2019. So let's get into the big picture for 2018 and 2019. Enjoy. Daniel, welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast.
Great to be back, Ben.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I think at this stage, no one will be breaking your record for number of appearances on the show, and it's always a pleasure to have you on and get your insights, so welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on again, and I hope that this year in review and predictions will become an annual occurrence.
It's a lot of fun. I love these things. The end of the year is always a great time to look back and reflect. And a lot of the things that we're dealing with, they're, some are not going to change year on year, but it's good to check in. And last year, we did this in person, and we talked about a number of things from Saudi Arabia to cryptocurrencies to cyber. And you also had a book come out this year on AI, which was excellent. So there's lots to talk about. I don't know if you have a preference around anything in 2018 that struck you the most from where we were last year. Was there anything on your list that you thought that was interesting the way that played out?
Yeah, actually, in reviewing the list, and this was outlined not only in our conversation, but in a piece that I wrote at the very end of last year for the Huffington Post, I reviewed the list, and I'm happy to say that I feel like I'm 10 for 10, which is not a bad thing to be able to say in the risk prediction business. But that all said, maybe we could just focus on a few of these. Some of these will not be surprising, of course. The idea that, you know, the U.S. Congress continued to stagnate, I think that was really totally predictable. And interestingly enough, I don't know that that's necessarily going to change in the coming year. I think the stage is set, if you will, for continued stagnation, given that we have a divided Congress. If it was going to be stagnating when it wasn't divided, imagine what it will be when it is. I don't imagine that this spirit of bipartisanship, which used to exist in the H.W. Bush and the Reagan era, is suddenly going to reappear. I really wish it would. And, you know, the passing of George Bush really sort of brought back in my mind that it wasn't so long ago when that was the norm, rather than the ridiculous divisive government that we have today in the United States and elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dive into that a little bit, because that was one of your areas, and you talked about, well, what might happen with the midterms, and if we got the result that I think you were forecasting, that we would have two more years of stagnation. What do you think that means for the rest of the Trump presidency, and whether or not he still, in your view, is a one or a two-term president?
I'm not sure it makes much difference, frankly, given that the first 2 years were largely governed by an inability to pass much of anything in the way of meaningful laws. That sounds a bit unfair, but much of what was done by executive mandate. And I suppose that's one way of ruling. And Mr. Trump is able to say that he's kept a number of his promises as a result of that and some other things that the Republicans managed to get through. But that's not what this is supposed to be about, right? It's supposed to be about something broader than the president's mandate. And I'm not at all optimistic that much of anything is going to change. What does it imply for him? I'm not sure there's much of a difference there either. The people who were inclined to favor him and vote for him, I think, are going to remain so. I don't see that changing at all. His favorability among the Republicans who voted him in has stayed extremely high, in the 80th, maybe even 90th percentile among that group. And oddly enough, he is actually rated higher now in December, in his second year, the end of his second year of rule, than Obama was at this point in his own presidency. So, you know, kind of a fun and surprising statistic, meaning to say that it's all relative. And I think much of this is going to be governed by what we expect. And if you have low expectations, you're not going to be disappointed.
Okay. That's that is perhaps the smart way to operate in these circumstances, and not expect too much. Turning our attention perhaps to what's happening outside of the U.S., you also talked about, one of the things that was quite interesting, which I think was perhaps one of your best forecasts, if you like, was around North Korea and what happened there, because I think you really nailed that. You talked about talks would happen, a deal would be struck, and we would move forward, and Trump would claim a victory. And that's pretty much how it's gone down, at least perception-wise, although the enforcement of that deal still leaves a number of questions unanswered. What's your view on the Korean Peninsula?
So I think the stagnation that has come to govern the landscape over the last 6 months or so is likely to simply continue. I think if either side was looking for a quick and meaningful victory, it would have happened by now. But that I think was unrealistic, if anyone had that expectation. We need look no further than, you know, the multi-decade history of the North Korean regime and how they have interacted with the West and previous outcomes of prior agreements to know that this was never going to be a quick or easy process. And, you know, I had actually written a couple of pieces in the course of the year suggesting to the Trump administration that they, you know, show clear evidence of their intent to make this happen. Because from my perspective, Kim Jong-un has actually done a great deal to do just that. You know, everything from, you know, dismantling guard posts with the South Koreans to dismantling some of his weapons production facilities, et cetera. From his perspective, and I think it's useful to view this process from his perspective, he's saying, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. What about the rest of you? So, you know, Trump put a temporary hold on exercises with the South Koreans, which was useful, and a couple of other things. But, you know, I don't really see anything too substantive here. And unfortunately, the Trump administration continues to say, you know, you must absolutely disarm before we're going to do anything meaningful on our side. That's not the way you're going to get to the finish line. So if it turns out that they maintain that stance, and I hope they don't, because this is a process and if you're not both inching forward, then you're not moving anywhere. That if they, if the Trump administration continues this way, I don't think this is necessarily going to succeed. And I think the Trump administration will largely be to blame based on what I know. Now, there may be things that are going on behind the scenes between the two governments that none of us know. But based on what I know, that's what I feel.
Mm. So tensions on the peninsula could come back in 2019, potentially.
If not 2019, perhaps the year after. But, you know, I remain hopeful that they're going to find a way to do this, because I know that Kim really wants to find a way to, you know, to come back into the fold after so many decades in isolation. And he understands that the world is proceeding apace without North Korea. And I think he wants his country to be part of it ultimately. This can't go on forever the way it is. That said, I don't know exactly how the timing is likely to work out. I remain optimistic that this is going to see a successful conclusion. But I think in 2019, we'll find out whether that is really just pie in the sky or not.
Let's stay in the region and perhaps talk about China. And this time last year, you were talking about the major consolidation in power and Xi really strengthening China's hand, which I think one could say he did. So where do you think that now goes? One Belt, One Road continues apace, it looks like, although there are some tensions with the likes of Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and others. But where does China go from here?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how things have played out? Because on one hand, you know, Xi strengthened his hand, and he's got these, position for life kind of mandate, and he's the strongest leader since Mao. That all said, things have not gone particularly swimmingly for him in the past 6 months in particular, as we know. And he's got, you know, some challenges internally with not everyone who's agreeing with the way he's approaching, the path forward for China from a domestic perspective. And of course, we know that Mr. Trump has clearly raised the ante in terms of this trade war that has occurred in recent months. I personally am very glad to see that an American president has finally stood up to China on intellectual property theft and a whole range of other things, because my study of the way China works is that they've been getting away with this now for decades with nothing more than a scolding, really, from the U.S. So I don't think that the Trump administration is asking for anything that's particularly unreasonable. Mm. It's just that the Chinese are unaccustomed to playing on a level playing field. And so I'm heartened to see that. And that all said, we can talk about this later, perhaps. There are a number of things that Mr. Trump is doing that I actually am really in favor of. And you don't have to like him or his tactics to necessarily like what he's trying to achieve. And so perhaps we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. I think that there's going to be a successful conclusion to the trade negotiations,
okay,
because there's just so much at stake. As we know, the Chinese economy is in deep trouble. Its currency, its stock market, a whole range of economic indicators do not point to a good 2019 and beyond for them. So that's certainly gotten their attention. And then, you know, I think Mr. Trump was right in using a simple calculation to say, well, when you're in a trade war with one side that only imports a quarter of the amount or a fifth of the amount that the other side does, then, you know, the side that has more to lose is going to lose. And that's exactly what's happening here. So the American economy is feeling some impacts, but it's really limited. That all said, there is no other alternative apart from finding a solution here. The stakes are just too high. Everybody is incentivized to find a way forward. I'm not so sure that's necessarily going to happen in the 90-day timeframe that has been allocated by Mr. Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up modifying that if progress is being made. So I would imagine that 2019 will see a resolution. I just don't think it's necessarily going to be in Q1.
Okay. That's interesting. And we can get to that when we talk about 2019. But to maybe wrap up the geopolitical side around things that we discussed this time last year, one of the interesting ones that we discussed that you mentioned was what's going to happen with Saudi Arabia MBS and what his agenda was. And that came to a very interesting conclusion, I guess, over the last few weeks with the Khashoggi murder. What do you make of those developments?
So at the time, I had expressed some question about whether this, what I called Saudi experiment, was going to proceed at pace and be successful. And that was largely based on the grandiosity of the things that MBS was trying to achieve. You know, Vision 2030 and NEOM, that city on the Red Sea mm-hmm. that was going to cost $500 billion, et cetera. Where was all this money going to come from for all this stuff? And he has still some very substantial opposition within the kingdom. And, you know, how is that likely to manifest itself? Those remain lingering questions. I think what the Khashoggi affair did was lay bare some of the contradictions and inconsistencies in what Saudi Arabia is and who MBS is. That all said, I think most countries have decided to simply hold their nose and perhaps look the other way because, let's face it, if Khashoggi had been addressed the way he had been in Saudi Arabia, it might be a headline but not an outrage. The issue is that, you know, he was an American resident and that this was done outside of the kingdom. That all said, I'm not sure it would have been too much of a story otherwise. So, but it is a story now. Yeah, the West can be outraged, and that's no way to treat journalists, etc. We can all agree on that. But at the end of the day, how many economies are willing to sacrifice their bilateral relationship with a country as important as Saudi Arabia because of this moral outrage? Well, to my knowledge, none of them have, and I don't expect any of them will. That's just the way realpolitik works. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really wasn't surprised, for instance, that Mr. Trump didn't modify the American stance. I don't think that any American president would have, frankly. So that's my take on that.
Okay. That's sort of the kind of the geopolitical side of your predictions or things to watch in 2018. But on geopolitics, was there anything that surprised you from the last 12 months?
I was surprised at how quickly and severely the Yellow Jacket movement has transpired in France. Mm. You know, in a way, you can look at French history and say, this isn't really too surprising. I mean, they have this revolutionary history and, you know, the people have revolted in the past. I think what's instructive about that is that it just goes to show that decades of bad government and poor policies and implementation will eventually catch up. And in the era that we're in, where this, you know, nationalism has intersected with populism and the little guy is getting the short end of the stick, just like he always did, I think it just reinforces how completely unpredictable political movements are. Mm. Now, that said, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Yellow Jacket movements now spring up elsewhere in Europe and beyond, because the genie has been let out of the bottle. This is not a new phenomenon, but it's been, you know, a while since something like this has happened in a place like France. It's unfortunate for Macron that he happens to be at the helm when all of this is happening, because it's really not his fault. There was just a spark in terms of this fuel subsidy policy, which happened to unleash the flame, and he happened to have been present. Beyond that, I'm not so sure that history will be too unkind to him. He's been in power for too short a time to take credit for all of the things that have been unleashed under his watch.
Right. You talked about, you know, political disruption last year, and it does seem to me that that is something that's quite significant in the rest of Europe in 2019 when you look at what's happening in places like Germany and Italy, in Hungary as well, that the polarization of politics in Europe in particular is very interesting. We've got European elections next year, and you're right that the genie may be out of the bottle now. It'll be a very interesting year on the continent
and beyond. Let's not forget these are now global phenomena, and as a result of social media, instant communication, globalization, etc., which are not new phenomena, but I think people have become more familiar with the power that they hold just by simply owning a cell phone or a laptop. And that, I think, is really a very, very interesting phenomenon. I sort of find myself wondering why more yellow jacket movements, why more Arab Spring type movements have not actually been unleashed in this era, because one would think that they would be. But then that also goes to talk about how governments monitor their citizens now and how they sometimes restrict their ability to communicate with one another, China being a really perfect example of that. And, authoritarian governments throughout the world are doing the same thing. And China, in fact, has shared a lot of the technology needed to do that. So I think this is going to remain a work in progress in terms of the impact that communication has on political movements. But we see that if they can get the formula right, anything can happen at any time. And that's fascinating and also frightening.
It's very volatile, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. One of the things that we were talking about this time last year that no one seems to be going crazy about are cryptocurrencies. It almost seems comical at the moment, right? This wild ride of where Bitcoin went to $20,000 and then just crashed, and it's been on this slow downward trajectory for the rest of the year. I mean, on the flip side of all of the political disruption we've been talking about is quite possibly that this whole cryptocurrency thing may have kind of flamed out, at least in terms of the bubble around cryptos.
Yeah, I think that's one of the predictions that I actually hit on the head a year ago. I've never been much of a fan of cryptocurrencies, largely because I don't think many people truly understand them and what they do. Apart from the fact that so many cyber criminals in the dark web actually use cryptocurrencies, that's one consideration. But I think people just got caught up in a traditional, conventional investment frenzy that is existed throughout history. And they didn't stop to think, why would people buy Bitcoin at $19,000 when it's done nothing but go up, right? The expectation, of course, was that the trajectory would do nothing but go up, but that's completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And especially if you look at the decade-long history of Bitcoin, it's had numerous crashes already within a decade. Hmm. So, for those who may be listening who may have gotten the short end of the stick on that, I'm sorry about that, but I don't know what else they expected maybe realistically would happen. A couple of weeks ago, I was interviewed by a business publication, was asking my views on this, and I said at the time, this was already when I think Bitcoin was in the 4,000 plus range, that it probably would settle in the $2,000 to $3,000 range. And I'll stick with that for the time being. It's done nothing but drop like a rock since then. Where's the bottom? I don't think that anybody knows. Mm-hmm. But what I predict will happen is that people will pick themselves up, dust off, and create a new bubble, which is what the investment community tends to like to do. So there will be plenty of people who will make a ton of money and plenty of people who are going to lose a ton of money in the process. I think, though, that until cryptocurrencies are properly understood and regulated, that this process of boom-bust is simply going to continue. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't. I think it's going to be some time before the regulatory regime is in place the proper way and before people really understand this stuff. Sure. It may well turn out to be the future, but if we don't understand the future, I'm not really sure what point being in the future holds.
Right, right. What about how we've done on more traditional investments, the equity markets? One of the things you did talk about was that the equity markets were seemingly overvalued. We were overdue for a recession, and we've been through a bumpy ride, but I don't think we can say that it's been a crash or that we're close, maybe we're close to recession, I don't know, but it does still feel like we're a bit insulated from the historical cycles of boom and bust. What's your view on the bull market phenomenon that we seem to have had leading up to 2018?
I think we've talked in the past about how history isn't the judge or the indicator that it used to be, that so many conventions and rules have been broken in the last decade or so that whether you're a stock picker or a political prognosticator, there's not necessarily too much point in looking at history as a guide to the future. I think the same is true, certainly with the equity markets. If it was based on history, we would have had that recession that's long overdue several years ago, and clearly we have not. I think we're clearly in a correction mode. Whether that turns into a recession or not, I think will largely depend on what happens with China and where global consumer confidence goes. With the amount of money that's been withdrawn from the global equity markets in the last few weeks, people seem to have been losing confidence, and there's every reason to understand that. They want to lock in profits, and you know they recognize that since 2010, there's only been basically one direction for the general marketplace, and that's been up. But people are skittish, and with good reason. If I was going to make a prediction, I would say we would have the beginning of a recession at some point next year. But it's a very dangerous type of predictive business to be in, because most people who make those predictions end up being wrong just because convention no longer applies.
Right.
So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. It's a dangerous game, this whole prediction business, Daniel. So very, very brave of you for stepping into it regardless, right? So excellent. So one of the things that we didn't talk about and would be good to maybe just touch on, because we have talked about it before, was around cybersecurity. And this is a theme that I think will continue, as you know, and have talked about extensively, is going to run through the way in which we live and work for many years to come. Was there any developments from the last year that surprised you or otherwise around the whole cyberspace?
Yes and no is the short answer.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is, you know, I speak to audiences all over the place about cybersecurity, and inevitably when I ask them, you know, what do you all do to protect yourselves and how often you change your passwords and update your software, and most people, they just still don't get it. And I don't understand how individuals and particularly businesses can not understand the importance of having good cyber hygiene, and yet audience after audience basically says more or less the same thing. There's a few people inevitably who get it right, and most everybody else seems to be pretty clueless. So that makes that an even more dangerous landscape. You know, how many different types and numbers of breaches do we need to have for people to understand that, yes, they have been breached, whether they realize it or not, their information is out there. If it wasn't, it soon will be. And I don't understand why a more robust position is not being taken by more individuals and businesses. You know, some businesses get it, especially the ones that have been impacted by some of these breaches. But until we start turning this into a proactive exercise rather than a reactive exercise, it's really just going to continue to be, if you will, shooting fish in a barrel for the bad guys who have, you know, a target-rich landscape and an easy way to get into a lot of different systems. That's going to keep the professionals in the cyber arena busy for many years to come. I hope we reach a turning point at some point in the not-too-distant future, but the landscape and the amount of vulnerability is just so great that I think the net favorability is going to be on the attacker's side for some time to come.
Okay. Well, I think you're right, and it's unfortunate. And as you also have talked about, you know, it's very difficult to attribute blame or causality for any of these types of breaches. So really, in risk management kind of parlance, the onus is on the individual and the organization to minimize the likelihood and the impact of what may happen, as opposed to try to flush out the root cause.
Well, that's exactly right. And at the end of the day, it's the small and medium-sized businesses that pay the greatest price. They have least amount of ability and resources available to throw at the problem. They have the least amount of orientation around the problem, and they're the ones who pay the highest price. Mm-hmm. The statistics say something that up to 90% of small and medium-sized businesses that experience a serious hack are out of business within 6 months.
Wow.
That's a frightening statistic, but it keeps continuing to be the case.
Wow.
If I could just add, Ben, I think a lot of that is because of the damage done vis-a-vis reputation risk. Mm. An Equifax can sustain that kind of a hit from what happened to them and their own response to it, but the average small business can't. Mm-hmm. People just don't want to do business with them. They just feel they're vulnerable, or the management was asleep at the wheel or whatever. And they're generally right, but that's one of those unfortunate statistics.
It is. And one of the things that small businesses really trade on is trust. Many small businesses trade on trust. Particularly in this era of online businesses, it's difficult to know who you're dealing with. And so building up that trust, and there are many ways to invest in trust with your customer base, that can be shattered in a moment. So you're right. And I wonder if there are some innovative solutions that small businesses could do, for example, combining with each other in smaller or industry organizations or something like this to be able to pool resources.
Yeah, the irony is that it really doesn't take much to make a substantial difference in turning the tables on the bad guys. You just do some basic things and be consistent with it and make sure that everyone in your organization is doing it, and you really shouldn't have much of a problem unless you're unfortunate enough to have been deliberately targeted by people who really know what they're doing. And let's not forget, that's the way a lot of industrial espionage is done these days. People don't look through trash cans anymore to find, an incriminating piece of paper. They're very sophisticated about how espionage is done. China, of course, has led the case from a national perspective. And I just try to make people more aware of this stuff in the discussions I have with them. And I'm hoping I'm making some bit of difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's turn our attention to 2019 and what is on your list in 2019. What are some of the things that are at the top of – what's at the top of your list for 2019?
Well, some of the stuff we've already touched on, but let me move on to some things that maybe we haven't. I want to talk about Trump and the Mueller investigation.
Okay.
Because I think even outside of America, a lot of people are interested in that. My view on that is that if a move to impeach him proceeds, and there's no guarantee that it will, and I've actually urged the Democratic Party not to do that because I don't think they're going to be successful. I don't think they will ever be successful in removing him from office. And the reason I say that is because it takes a two-thirds vote in the Senate to impeach a president, and the Democrats don't have a two-thirds vote. They don't even have a 50% vote in the Senate.
Right.
So it's never going to happen. And if it's never going to happen, then why proceed on that basis? Simply to show in history that they tried to impeach him or called him on some of his actions. I happen to think that Trump is too smart to ever be caught. The trail of breadcrumbs may lead to his door, but in terms of something which is clearly legally indefensible and that can be proven, I don't see it. Hmm. I mean, maybe the Mueller investigation is going to come up with something that none of us realize, but I really wish that both sides would spend their time legislating and governing rather than trying to, score one up on Trump in this regard. It doesn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in the Senate, the Republicans just Trump has too much of a stranglehold on that support. So, as you
That's
say,
right.
it doesn't from an outcome perspective, it doesn't make much sense. But what about from the supporters of the Democratic Party? I mean, to appeal to the support base, it almost feels like they have to do something. They have to try to impeach Trump if there is indeed something incriminating from the Mueller investigation.
Well, so let's see what happens if Mueller has the goods. You know, a lot of people are skeptical about that because mm-hmm. they thought, well, if he had the goods, why hasn't he displayed the goods? And maybe he's just being incredibly thorough. And, you know, in the first half of next year, we'll finally see what's under the kimono.
Right.
And I think either way, that's going to happen. Fine. That's his job. And that's what he's been focused on for the last 2 years. I really just wish that somehow, you know, the Republicans and Democrats would find a way to do something meaningful and govern, as we discussed earlier in this conversation. I don't have much hope that that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I just really wish they would focus on something else.
Right. But it will create the headlines for the foreseeable future. So I suppose there's no getting around that, because a lot of momentum's already been built up that something's going to happen. So what is the truth? And as you say, perhaps Trump is a little too smart. He does strike me as a sort of classic mafia boss type of operator, in which there'll be no direct links to him.
Yeah, you can be sure all of his lieutenants will fall. Many of them already have. But I don't think they're going to get the old guy, honestly.
Right.
We'll see about that. But this points to something even more disturbing, and that is that in America, we've become so desensitized to sensationalism mm-hmm. and to focusing on things that really don't and shouldn't matter that lots of things get lost in the process. And it's sad to me that in this country and some others around the world that, this 5-second soundbite matters more than achieving some governing milestone. I'm really depressed.
Yeah,
by all of that.
I mean the whole Mueller thing, it does read like a thriller, and it's almost like Brexit here, where I've likened it a little bit to a television series, and you know the next episode of what's going to happen, and in the meantime, here in the UK, we've been paralyzed by this Brexit thing, and for the last 2 years, what other things could the government have gone on and done to make the country better? Education, you know, addressing income inequality, you know, all of the things are actually the root cause of a lot of what's happened. And I suspect it's very similar across the pond.
Isn't that the case, though, right? Why aren't leaders, the political establishment, why aren't they listening to, you know, the real story that is underlying all of these things? Why instead are they simply insisting on this brinksmanship and, you know, scoring political points? I think at some point, UK, US, France, wherever it is, people are just going to get fed up and say, I've had enough. I mean, I would argue, and we're getting a little off the subject, but let me just say this. Mm-hmm. I would argue that in America, what we really need is a good old-fashioned revolution in the entire political process, which stinks to high heaven with our institutionalized, legalized corruption, with, you know, everything from voting on the first Tuesday of November, which was based on 150 years ago when we were in agricultural economy. The idea of having, you know, two senators for every state, no matter what the size, regardless of population, this stuff is ridiculous now. And nobody's willing to stand up and actually say, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. And it isn't that different here. There is, you know, people are fed up. And it boggles my mind here that there actually are, the majority of people here in the UK are fairly sensible, right? And you wouldn't think that would be the case from, you know, what you hear in the news. But there's a failure of the political leadership to actually just to govern very effectively. And I think there's a failure in this, particularly in the political center, that this should be the perfect time for someone sensible to be able to swoop in and just say, this is what we're doing. But it's structural. I think it's similar to what happens in the US. The voting mechanisms are ancient. The structures are old and dated, and maybe we do need a new form of governing. Maybe that is something that will happen over the next several years.
Well, I think we can live in hope. You know, I wrote a piece at the beginning of this year, basically suggesting, laying a platform out and suggesting that we revamp all this stuff, at least in the U.S. And I thought, you know, what kind of a response is this going to get? And I was hopeful that it would actually maybe create a spark that started a fire. It fizzled out spectacularly. And I think I made a call at the bottom of the article to anyone who wanted to, you know, reach out and, you know, roll up your sleeves and get this thing started. And I'm sad to say that only a dozen people out of whoever knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions who might have read it, bothered to respond. Now, they were very passionate. But this points to something that I think is also a real contributor to where we are and why we are here today, which is political apathy. You know, there's a lot of people in a lot of places in the world that are pretty comfortable and not necessarily interested in rocking the boat, or don't believe that if they did rock the boat, it would necessarily mean anything. And I think that's a big part of the entire problem here. If people were motivated to get involved, it would make a big difference. It's not just about voting. It's about political activism. And in a place like the U.S. and the U.K., you could argue that there's really no excuse for not being politically active in some way. And I would say, you know, 99 out of 100 people probably have no interest whatsoever in doing so. It's another piece of the pie.
Right. Well, it's the divisiveness. I mean, who wants to talk about politics? Who wants to have a rational, critical conversation about things? Very few. Very few people.
Well, certainly in this country, over Thanksgiving and holiday dinners, most people are on tenterhooks, which is also a sad statement of affairs. How many people that I even know, you know, have lost friends or refused to talk to relatives because they happen to be on the opposite side of the political divide? It's just silly. Yeah. And yet, it is what it is. The stakes are high.
It is what it is. Yeah. All right. Well, that's unfortunate. But as you say, we can only hope. Maybe it requires a few more crises. I'm not sure.
Well, they'll be coming down the pike. Don't worry about it.
So let's talk about some of the other things that you're watching or you'll be watching in 2019.
Okay. So I do have a few things on the list. One of them, interestingly, is the backlash against the Belt and Road Initiative vis-a-vis China. And what's happened in a number of African and Asian countries is that, especially from the smaller or poorer ones, they've realized that these loans that they're taking out from China for these infrastructure projects, they've got to be repaid. And they cannot be repaid. The debt load is simply too high, and these political leaders have, you know, sort of figured it out too late in the process that what they're doing is, in essence, selling their countries down the river in some cases. That's one component of it, and I think there's an interesting second side to that question. So on one hand, there's a backlash to the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative. On the other hand, you see a phenomenon as what's happening in the Philippines, where Duterte recently hosted Xi, and they, you know, had dozens of agreements that were signed, including the idea of joint exploration of oil and gas in the Philippines' own exclusive economic zone, which just boggles my mind. So, you know, on one hand, you've got the Hague ruling from 2016, which was handed to the Philippines, or should I say handed to the Chinese, which basically said, you know, this whole idea that you own the South China Sea is not consistent with modern maritime and territorial law, which anyone with some common sense could have told the Chinese. And yet, on the other hand, you see what many people would view as this capitulation by Duterte. A Duterte of all people, right?
Right.
Just mystifying to me. So there's this really interesting duality that's going on in the world now. On one hand, people saying, I've had enough of the BRI. On the other hand, people saying, come a little closer. We actually welcome your dollars, and we need your aid and participation, and we're better off without you. I can't explain it.
Yeah, well, they call it the debt trap diplomacy that China is pursuing. And I had on the podcast a few weeks ago Congressman Gary Alejano from the Philippines, and he's part of the opposition to Duterte. And he has talked about that, and we had a discussion about the war on drugs in his country. One of his interesting observations was that the price of methamphetamine, which is known locally as shabu, has gone down in the midst of all of the war on drugs, which is interesting because you would have thought that a constrained supply would cause the price to go up. But there's an oversupply of the stuff, and most of it comes from China, interestingly. So it's very interesting.
Well, that's one of the components of what Trump and Xi apparently have agreed to tackle in the next 90 days. And that is that a lot of the oxycodone and other type of drugs that are causing a crisis on this side of the pond, they come from China also. And I think many people didn't realize that this is ultimately from a supply perspective, the source of the problem. Then there's the demand perspective, which is something else. But yeah, that's right. I think, you know, China's got tentacles in so many aspects of Western economies and societies. We don't even realize how intertwined they are. It's fascinating.
It is. It is very fascinating. Okay. What else is on the list? The top of the list.
So let's see that I haven't yet talked about. I had made a prediction last year about where I thought the price of oil was going to be, and I had suggested it would go as high as the 70s, perhaps the 80s briefly, and that seems to be pretty much what happened. What I think is likely to happen now is that we'll reach some sort of an equilibrium, not in the 50s and not in the 70s, but maybe the 60s, where the marketplace seems to be pretty comfortable from a supply and demand perspective about what is an appropriate price for oil and subsequently gas and all the services that go with it. So I'm going to suggest that maybe it'll be in the 60s. I'm not anticipating, although nobody can know for sure, any crises related to supply. The world seems to be pretty stable, especially since the U.S. has become the world's largest supplier of oil. And that's really changed the dynamics. OPEC also, we've seen a couple of its members in the recent weeks have either said they're going to withdraw, as in the case of Qatar, or in the case of some other countries, have said they would consider withdrawing from OPEC. So that's really, I think, going to be a very interesting dynamic on the price of oil going forward.
Right, right. We'll see how that plays out. Interesting. And what about in the cyber space? Anything that is new that you're watching out for, anything around? So we talked a bit about AI and the nexus between AI and cyber in the past. Are there things that you are going to be watching in that area in 2019? I'm sure there are plenty, but in terms of the
one thing I'm one thing that I'm waiting for is the next round of global ransomware attacks.
Okay.
Sort of curious that none have really happened of any major consequence since WannaCry and the NotPetya. Clearly, you know, the sources of these being either North Korea or Russia in large part, those two countries haven't gone anywhere. Either they're going to become stealthier or more sophisticated in how they do this, or the safeguards that can be put in place are going to become more robust. But, you know, I'm fearful that we're getting into a kind of a cycle where, you know, it's just a question of time till the next ransomware attack on a global basis happens. And, just as quickly as those safeguards are put into place, you know, the bad guys are thinking of new ways to attack. And that sort of broken record, I think, is going to continue for some time to come. As for AI, just very briefly, I think that China is going to become supreme in AI much quicker than even they anticipate, just by virtue of the velocity with which they have approached the subject and the amount of money and resources they're devoting to it. I think most people would already argue that China has assumed the de facto lead. I was in Singapore about 3 weeks ago, and I happened to meet up with Kai-Fu Lee, who also has a book out on this subject. And of course, he's a big fan of waving the China flag on this particular front. But I think in large part, he's justified. You know, listen to his pitch and here are some of the things that are going on in China just by the sheer volumes of data that are being created through daily activities. And you have to believe that they're finding a way to harness this stuff. And they're also gradually sort of leaving the rest of the world in the dust. So, you know, if the rest of the world is not ready to spend similar types of money and devote similar types of resources, then I think the race has already basically been won by China.
Wow. Interesting. Mm. That has profound implications.
It does indeed. I think we all need to get more comfortable with the idea that the implications for AI will be profound on every one of us going forward. There was just a report I was listening to this morning, kind of funny, about some woman's parrot who figured out a way to start barking orders to Alexa.
I saw that, yeah.
Every time she woke up, she had new orders on Amazon.
Yeah.
Is a parrot controlling our destiny with Alexa?
Yes, right.
I find myself asking.
I also, the headline also from, I guess, a day ago that I thought also perfectly described our times was this one from The Independent, Sex Robot Conference Canceled Over Backlash to Proposed Speech by Steve Bannon.
On that particular subject, it will not surprise anyone to learn that, you know, where sex robot brothels are concerned, they've been breaking records with pre-orders and everybody wants to get in on the act, maybe because it's the new thing, but also because maybe robots are the ideal lovers. You know, they do whatever they're told until somehow there's a software glitch and they end up strangling you in the process.
you never know. And that may be how we perish as a species, or one of the factors of how we might perish in the coming decades. But we'll see.
That's a great way to envision our launch into 2019.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to throw in a positive one then here, if you've got one.
Well, I remain optimistic that things are basically going to turn out okay. I mean, think about it this way. Everyone assumed that it was going to be the end of the world when Mr. Trump came to power and that World War III was inevitable, et cetera. I just don't see it that way. I think there's too many people with too many entrenched interests to make sure that things go pretty smoothly overall. And until or unless there is something completely unpredictable and unexpected that, you know, overturns the apple cart, my expectation is that, you know, we're unlikely to have any major real problems. You know, an asteroid could come smashing into the world unexpectedly, or there could be some natural disaster that nobody's anticipating.
I have one to maybe complement that. Is I've been exposed to this whole startup community and kind of ecosystem in the last few weeks, and I'm very encouraged by the ideas that are incubating all over the world around all kinds of things, whether that's plastic in the oceans or the role of social media. I think we are waking up to the way social media manipulates us and things like mental health, and people are fighting back a little bit and communicating better. And I think that we've got, particularly the younger people, I'm very encouraged by the level of awareness to how we might be, how we are kind of disconnecting from one another as a species. And there's some wonderful ideas kicking around about how to solve that problem or those types of problems. So I'm more encouraged in the last several weeks than I had been leading up to it. So we'll see. One of my previous guests, John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, he did talk about a kind of consciousness revolution happening around the world. And I think there's something to that. I think there is something going on.
I think it's an extension of corporate social responsibility, and maybe you could say it's CSR on steroids. But at the end of the day, for instance, being green creates green. People figure out ways to make money as a result of the green revolution, for example. And consumers are much more orientated to doing business with companies that are perceived to be doing the right thing. So in that regard, I think there is hope for an optimistic landscape where that is concerned, where more and more companies are willingly choosing to do the right thing, and more consumers are rewarding them for having done so.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is happening. There was also a very interesting article in the Financial Times earlier this week, of all places, right? So the UK's version of the Wall Street Journal, when they talked about this article is by Martin Wolf, who's a longtime writer for the FT, and he was arguing about the need for the corporation to have a definite purpose, that just making money isn't really a purpose anymore, and that is actually a risk management strategy, effectively, is what he was saying, which I fully agree with. And I think there are, and you've talked about this in your Global Risk Agility book, that there are some things like that are, you know, the importance of values and how values can be very effective in just, well, even when an organization is up against a crisis, that just having a sort of a true north in the sense of values can help see that organization through a difficult period.
Well, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And it's just common sense if you really think about it. I just think that the corporate world isn't accustomed to thinking of things in those terms.
No.
I think most businesses are going to go along with an approach like that as long as their bottom line benefits from
it. Correct.
Unfortunately, this is a cynical view, but probably a realistic view at the same time. So as long as they can proceed with a purpose and still make money, that's fine. I mean, you look, for example, at what Pepsi tried to do several years ago with, you know, going into health food and standing for a healthy lifestyle and all this stuff. Well, it didn't really help their bottom line very much, so they didn't stick with it for very long. So I remain hopeful on that front. I think with a guy like Wolf, you know, elevating this in the pages of the FT, maybe it will cause more corporate leaders to think about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I would hope so. Also, though, I reflect on something that you said when we spoke, I think a year and a half ago, when we were talking about global risk agility. Maybe it was a little bit longer, but the role of corporate governance and people that sit as non-executive directors, and around the world, we need a shakeup of that community, because just like the political structures are ancient, I think the corporate governance structures and the thinking in corporate governance is pretty ancient.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, it just added to the list of the things that need to be disrupted in a pretty serious way. Some of this is occurring by inertia when organizations, you know, have a bad experience and they figure out that they need to do something differently. Again, my hope would be that it wouldn't take a crisis to cause organizations to reexamine this issue. And I think also worth adding that now that reputation risk can be caused not necessarily by someone within your organization, but by actors outside it, really important to have a proper defensive approach to this subject. And so many organizations don't, so many boards are not switched on to this thing. Inertia, I think, will solve that problem.
True. Right. Should we go back to the dark side a little bit and finish round off your list of top things?
Well, let's see. The dark side. It's dark and foreboding. Let me just run down some of these things very quickly. Some of this we've already covered, but I'll just reiterate it. I'll stick with the idea that we'll be having some sort of a recessive movement at some point in 2019. We're way, way, way overdue for it. I will say that Europe is going to become even more fractured than it is.
I agree.
And that its surge to the right will continue and only become exacerbated as a result of the immigrant issue and the yellow jackets and a whole host of other things. But that's not a good outcome for the average person. But on the other hand, if we look throughout history, we see that Europe and other places in the world have gone through these phases where they, you know, shift left and shift right. And maybe this is just part of that natural process. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I would also say that there's a pretty good chance that there will be some serious political machinations that occur in various places of the world as a result of what the trend that has already been established, right? Right-wing movements, more authoritarian-type governments, even in democracies, et cetera. Question is, how is this going to manifest itself in the coming year and beyond? What will people's reaction to it be? Are they going to remain apathetic, or are they going to roll up their sleeves and get out in the street? People have, you know, been saying the Yellow Jacket movement is far overdue in the U.S. of A., no doubt in the U.K. as well. Could we see it next year? Unlikely, but you never know. I think it's just more of the sheer unpredictability and the reign of the unexpected that is surely going to continue in the coming year.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good sort of round list. Was there anything else on there that you didn't get a chance to touch on?
I think we've covered most everything. I will leave it there.
Okay, perfect. Well, I suppose to maybe wrap things up, were there things that individuals or organizations might do that they may not be doing now to manage some of this disruption or take advantage of it or exploit it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I would really like to see a movement in the direction of international organizations that are going to be able to better define and regulate and govern the cyber arena, the AI arena, and other aspects of the global economy that are just a sort of a free-for-all now. Mm-hmm. This is going to be something that will be a multi-year process. It's going to take a long time. But if we don't get started, it's just never going to happen. So I would like to see a movement, you know, maybe among some multilateral institutions, perhaps among the top corporates, to start agreeing on some common themes and perhaps even sharing some information to get toward that goal. If we don't, and we just rely on the winds to help us define what happens next in these arenas, we're going to be regretting it in the next decade. The stakes are really high in that regard as well. I've called for the creation of such organizations in my two previous books, Virtual Terror and AI Supremacy. And I'm going to stick by it because I don't see much of anything has been done. The UN deserves credit for having started this process in the AI and cyber arenas, but it's only a start. Mm-hmm. And they're going to need a lot of support in order to gain some traction and make some real progress.
Okay. That's great. Good list and discussion. Before we finish, is there anything that you're working on in the coming months that we need to know about?
Well, I suppose I will let the genie out of the bottle with you, Ben. What better place to do it? What better time to do it? I am, if you will not be surprised, to learn that I am actually working on yet another book. New year, new book, right?
It's right.
Getting a little silly. This one is actually a book that I've wanted to write for a long time. It's on China. And it's based on 30 plus years of traveling and observing there as a student of China. And it's going to be my observations on how China sees the world and what some of the implications are.
Fabulous. When does that come out?
I'm targeting the end of Q1.
Wow.
It's already about half written, so I'm hopeful that in the next several months I'll be able to get that done. And I think I probably will, because I actually looked at the amount of writing that I've done over the last 10, 15 years on China, and I came up with something like 70 articles that I had already published. And so I thought, well, this, you know, will help create the makings of a new book. And it certainly made the book writing process a little bit easier, I must say.
Okay. Well, I was just about to ask, like, what is your writing superpower? Because you are incredibly prolific. And it's amazing how, you know, how much good stuff that you produce. So
I appreciate that, Ben.
You might you might be able to also market how to write you know, prolifically.
Well, thanks for saying that. I have a gift, fortunately. I research and I write very quickly, and I generally don't have to do much rewriting when it's on the paper. You know, I edit it a little bit and spruce it up a little bit, but I think that really, really speeds up the process. The other thing that's the secret to getting published relatively easily and relatively quickly is to avoid the major publishing houses.
Right, right.
And to actually publish through Amazon, for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's incredibly simple. Once you have the wording formatted, and once you've got your cover artwork, you literally upload them both to Amazon, press the button, and it's published. So no more 12 to 18 month agonizing editorial processes with major publishing houses, no more headaches. That makes a big, big difference and is a real motivating factor to people like me to actually want to continue to publish, because it becomes a rewarding process.
Sure. Well, that's fantastic. I look forward to that that book coming out, and of course, we'll have to have you back to talk about it, right?
I would be delighted to make our day two on All Things Risk.
Fantastic. Well, we've covered a lot for this for this episode, including, you know, last year, this coming year, and a whole bunch of stuff in between. But was there anything else that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to mention?
No, I'm pretty confident the sun is going to rise tomorrow, and it's going to set in the same direction it's supposed to set. So I'll leave it at that, Ben. Thank you very much for having me on.
Fantastic, Daniel. Thank you so much. And we will, I'm sure we'll talk in 2019, but have a wonderful holiday season and a wonderful, I wish you all the best for 2019. But thank you once again.
And you. Thanks again.
I hope you guys found that interesting and useful. What are your views on the world in 2019? Let me know. Drop me an email at allthingsrisk@gmail.com or drop a comment in the post accompanying this episode. And of course, subscribe at allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. We'll be back soon with our best of 2018 episode in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.